nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
And Larry Baxter, it's my pleasure to introduce him. Larry Baxter is from Brigham Young University. He's a professor of chemical engineering there. He got his bachelor's and PhD degrees from Brigham Young University. His advisor for his PhD was Dr. Phil Smith. And then after graduation, Larry came out to the combustion research facility at Sandia National Labs at Livermore, California, not in Albuquerque. And so we were both staff members there for, we overlapped for several years until I left in 1992. Larry was there until 2000 when he left to accept a position as a professor of chemical engineering at Brigham Young University, and that's where he is now. So with that, Larry,
all right.
Looking forward to your talk.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here. The title that I sent and that was on the flyer is maybe a little more provocative than the one that I have here, but my passion is and always has been sustainable energy. And the frustration that I have is that it seems in the last few years, sustainable can be attached to just about anything these days. It's a little bit in engineering like linear. There's almost anything that can be called linear, and the meaning of that term varies dramatically. And specifically with the case of sustainable, is if you look at the outcomes of processes that people advertise as sustainable, in many cases they're kind of diametrically opposed. They accomplish different things. So today I will talk to you about what I think of as sustainable energy, but in particular, the theme is, like the title that I sent in to Melissa, is that I think that we talk too much, perhaps, about a lot of things, including sustainable energy, and there's a lot that we could do. There's actually a great deal that could be done right now that makes sense, that would significantly advance things, and I'll talk about several of those processes. So for an outline, I'll start with some highlights from some of our laboratory experiments. So if you're a lab rat, these will be perhaps the best part of this presentation. I'll show you several things which I think are the first time that some of these experiments have done, but I'll also show you the process of going from very fundamental small-scale experiments, single particle experiments, for example, to commercial scale applications of those experiments at commercial power plants, where in one case we burn a few micrograms of coal, in the other case just last week placed an order for 72,000 tons of coal for an experiment that we're doing in Europe on related to some of this work. So we go all the way from a very small scale to a very large scale application, and we'll start there, and then I'll talk about energy, economy, and environment. I'll show you some real solutions to real problems. One of the things I'd like to do is dispel what used to be a widely held belief, I think, is that the energy industry is an old, tired, and relatively lethargic industry. It really never was that way, and it's especially not going to be that way in the future. So we'll look at some of the past and accomplishments of the past, but especially we'll look at what's happening in the future. I'll present to you some comparisons of some different process alternatives for addressing sustainability now, including one that we have innovated at BYU recently, which at least on paper looks to be a significant improvement over the alternatives. And then finally, I'll end up, if you're more of a philosophy type of person, I'll talk a little bit at least about my philosophy and where my passion comes for sustainability and what I view as the long-term future, and especially for the students in the room, what I view as both the challenge and the opportunity in the generations to come in addressing this issue. So let me start with a couple of these kinds of presentations. One of the experiments that we've come up with, a Millikan oil drop experiment a long time ago, was a way to suspend a particle using electrodynamic balance. And there has long been a real need to be able to monitor what happens to one coal or biomass or other kind of combusting particle, aluminum or other kinds of things, and watch that one particle over its entire lifetime. But for a variety of reasons, that's been essentially impossible. And a number of people decided they were going to try this Millikan oil drop experiment type of thing. You charge a particle and put it in an electrodynamic balance, and with that balance, you maintain the particle where you can watch what happens to it over time. But this often happens in the United States. Just another week working in the library and on paper could have saved about a year of expensive laboratory work. And it turns out that you cannot maintain on a charge on a particle at a temperature that makes any interest to combustion. So the particles would lose their charge and fall out of the balance long before they become interesting for any kind of a combustion experiment. So we got the idea that maybe we can, in fact, at the time I decided to leave Sandia, this was the project that I wanted to, first project I wanted to try at the university, and that is to suspend the particle on the laser beam. And so this is an example. We suspend them on a variety of laser beams. But these are a few particles actually shown here. If you look in the details, this is a laser beam, in this case, upwardly directed, and it's actually levitating. In this case, a whole variety of particles. Sometimes we get one and sometimes others. And we suspend them in the air and can suspend them indefinitely, particles of a variety of sizes. And then what's perhaps a little bit surprising is that we can suspend them in the laser beam regardless of the orientation of the laser beam relative to gravity. So you can use horizontal beams or vertical beams or any combination of those. You can even use downwardly directed beams to suspend a particle in this laser beam. And so just working out what's going on in the physics of all of this has taken some time, but it's been quite successful. And that alone has been fairly fun. But then what do you do with a particle once you have it suspended? So in this next series of experiments, this, by the way, for these opaque particles, I believe these are the first successful experiments of these type that I know of anywhere. There's a technique by which you can suspend transparent particles, typically in water or something like that, using laser tweezers, but it works on a completely different principle than this one. And so for opaque particles, those are some of the first in the world. And these are also firsts, I think, although the ideas are fairly simple. So once we get the particle suspended, first we can use just a regular RGB camera, red, green, blue camera, and a photograph of an emitting particle. This doesn't work in something where you have reflected light, but if in a system where the source of the light is an emission from the surface, we essentially just use the RGB camera as a very poor man's spectrometer. The camera divides the light into frequencies, and by taking the ratio of the strength of the signal of the light in these different frequencies, integrate them over a certain range, we can develop a pixel by pixel temperature measurement of the temperature of the particle. And so that's what's shown here in the top. Meant to push the red button. So this is, in this case, a biomass particle, and we're looking at it from three orthogonal directions here. This is the particle, and this is the temperature map of that particle, looked at from three different directions, and this is if you put all the temperature maps together, choosing those three orthogonal directions, we developed a computer algorithm where you can recreate first the three-dimensional surface of the particle and then use the temperature measurements to paint the surface temperature on that three-dimensional particle. And we learned some pretty interesting things here. So this is the three-dimensional particle in the computer program that we have. You can rotate that around and look at all the different sides. But in this particular case, air is coming from the bottom and going to the top. And if you look at the temperature scale here, we go anywhere from nearly 1800 Kelvin here to a little over 1200 Kelvin at this location. So there's several hundred Kelvins of degrees difference in the temperature of this particle from the front end, from the highest temperature at the front end to the lowest temperature at the back end. And those kinds of surface temperature gradients have have never been measured or modeled on these kinds of particles. We'll talk a little bit about some experiments and why those things are important. And this is just an illustration of how the algorithm works. So this is a not the same particle, just a different particle. If you can take pictures of it from several different directions, minimally three orthogonal directions, and turns out working out some math, which is basically tomography, you can regenerate the three-dimensional, or at least a good approximation for the three-dimensional shape of the particle. From that, you can calculate some engineeringly important numbers like a surface area to mass ratio and other kinds of things which have large impacts on the ways that particles combust. So this too is, I think, a first in terms of laboratory experiments. And so why does this matter? So these are both models and measurements of particle temperatures. In this particular case, we use the emissive, the RGB camera weighted system to measure the surface temperature. But in this particular particle, we've suspended the particle on a thermocouple so we can also measure the center temperature of the particle and get an idea of the difference between the surface temperature and the center temperature. So you can see the model and data agree quite well here. There's some significant disagreement between the model and the data here. One of the secrets to doing good work like this is that make sure the same person does the modeling and the experiments, otherwise you end up with a lot of finger pointing going on. In this case, the model is actually more accurate than the data. This is a spherical particle, and this is in a combustion environment, and a significant amount of heat is actually transferred along the thermocouple leads, and it heats up the bead at the center to a temperature that's unrealistically high. So it's being heated not by the surrounding particle, but by the metallic leads that go to the thermocouple center. And that biases the actual temperature of the bead fairly significantly, and we can demonstrate that. I don't have the data here, but if you're interested, I can show you. We use cylindrical particles, and we can thread the thermocouple either the axial direction or the radial direction, and when we thread it the axial direction, the particle itself shields the thermocouple from most of that heat, and we get the temperature measurement that corresponds almost precisely with the predicted temperature. And so significantly here, during the combustion history of this particle, the temperature difference from the center to the surface of the particle can be many hundreds, approaching 1,000 degrees. And so those are very large differences in these particles. Now, if you were to take the standard, say, fluent-based type of, or almost anybody's calculation for a particle of this size and say, what would we predict would happen with this particle if we use a spherically symmetric isothermal particle kind of assumption, the blue line that I have here shows that prediction. And so the actual behavior of the particle differs by about a factor of three in terms of how long it takes the particle to ignite and combust relative to what you would predict with a simplified model that doesn't account for the shape and size effects and the internal temperature gradients and other kinds of effects in these particles. So this is also pretty interesting, so if you'll excuse me being a professor here for just a minute, it's actually pretty instructive to ask yourself what's happening with the center temperature. So initially, it starts off fairly flat. If you look at the details of that temperature, it actually never boils. It never quite gets to the boiling point of water, but these particles start off fairly moist, and as they dry out, the center is slightly below the boiling point of water in this case, and then it starts to climb as the center starts to devolatilize. You see a fairly significant, it climbs, I don't know if you can appreciate that there's a big increase in the slope here, and then it starts to decrease. So you see all these kinks in these surfaces, and when we get a center temperature measurement, we actually follow all of those kinks. And so this one is actually associated with, if you can appreciate from this graph, the bulk of the particle is reacting in this region, so there's a lot of mass being ejected from the particle, and the effect of the mass ejection from the particle on the heat transfer to the particle is dramatic. It actually reduces the heat transfer in many cases by well over 90%. So the particle heat up rate actually slows down as the particle starts to react because of what many people call the blowing factor. Then when the blowing factor stops, then the particle starts to heat up again rapidly. Then there's a reaction rate that goes here, and then now you're down to just ash, and the particle heats up very rapidly because there's less mass and no blowing going on at all, and eventually comes to an equilibrium temperature at the end. So those are the kind of fundamental experiments we do on individual particles. We try to understand them both from an experimental and a mathematical standpoint. And then we look at the fates of these particles. In this case, One of the things with all low-grade fuels, which would include any ash-forming fuel, is that what a lot of combustion people don't recognize, or at least fail to mention if they do recognize, is that burning the fuel, that is converting the carbon and hydrogen to water and CO2, is the simple part of the process. In any industrial application, it's actually the material that's left over after you burn the fuel that has the overwhelming impact on the process. So, for example, the ash, for example, the reason, if you were to take two coal-fired power plants, that one designed to burn, for example, Indiana coal, and the other one designed to burn Wyoming coal, and set them side by side, same net output of electrical power, the one that's designed to burn the Wyoming coal would have about twice the volume of the one that's designed to burn the Indiana coal. It has nothing, and it turns out the Wyoming coal is actually more reactive. The carbon and hydrogen convert more easily, burn more easily in the Wyoming coal, but the reactor has to be twice the size, and that has everything to do with the inorganic portion of the fuel and nothing to do with the organic part. So specifically, it forms a very white, very bright ash layer that coats all of the surfaces. So all coal conversion equipment are used to having the surfaces coated with ash. But when you coat them with a very bright ash, it reflects most of the radiative energy. And so you have to create more surface area in order to absorb the same amount of energy when you have a very white, bright ash as opposed to a dark ash, which is produced from most eastern coals. So the rate of ash accumulation on the surface and the properties of those ash deposits are critical parameters in designing these. And this just shows one experiment to show where sometimes you can think too hard. This is flow around a, in many portions of these boilers, at the tops of these boilers, you have flow going across the heat transfer surface. And so you basically have a tube in cross flow, and these are particles, particle trajectories that are shown that go across these tubes. And some of these particles you can see are colliding with the surface. And part of this trick is to figure out, first of all, how many collide with the surface, and of those that collide, how many of those ash particles actually stay on the surface, and what do they do once they stay on the surface. But one of those things is just getting the collision parameter. So classically, you could describe the flow around there, and to the eye, it looks pretty realistic with a potential flow theory. So using just an inviscid flow and a relatively simple mathematics, you can describe a flow field around that probe. And that flow field is useful in teaching fluid mechanics, but it's not useful. It's not an accurate description. In fact, those potential flow fields in general are quite inaccurate descriptions of the actual flows that go around systems. But the inaccuracies aren't always so obvious. So, what's shown here is that. So this is the actual flow around a surface. This flow is going from right to left. And this is the potential flow theory that goes from left to right here. And I've put them back to back to just to look at these streamlines of flows around those cylinders. And it's fairly subtle to the eye. If you were to look at those separately, they would look quite similar, actually. You'd say those are basically the same predictions. But if you remember the streamline theory, so the volumetric flow rate of gas between any two of those streamlines is the same. And so since these streamlines are further apart than those streamlines, that means the velocity here has to be quite a bit lower than the velocity in this case. And what that is a result of the presence of this probe actually creates a stagnation point here and a high pressure wedge that goes a fair distance up the upstream from where that probe is located. And so the flow in the real flow, it starts to sense the presence of that probe well before it gets to the particle, or well before it gets to the surface, and it starts to separate around that surface quite a bit earlier than it does in the potential flow field. In the potential flow field, that isn't nearly as pronounced of a pressure wedge. And the consequence is that the particles actually flow around here easier than they would in the potential flow theory would suggest. And if you were to, you can characterize that impaction rate with what's called a Stokes number. And I won't go into the details there, but it's basically it's just the ratio of the particle time constant to the fluid dynamics time constant of in this flow. And for many, many years, there's a well-publicized correlation based upon inviscid flow theory that people have used for over 30 years now to try to predict what fraction of these particles are actually going to strike that surface, and that's shown here with the solid blue line. But if you correct that with a more rigorous fluid mechanics calculation, the purple line here shows the theory, and then if you do a bunch of experiments, as have been done here, these dots show the experimental verification of the actual impaction rates on those surfaces based upon laboratory experiments. And they don't agree entirely with the prediction, but they're considerably closer to this viscous flow approximation than they are to the inviscid flow. Relative to here, there's a 30 and in some cases a 40% difference, 40% decrease in that impaction efficiency if you use the more rigorous theory. There are also error bands shown on here, so a good question to ask is, if this is the error band, then the error bands are actually smaller than the data points, so these are relatively well-collected, precise data based upon replicated experiments. So why can't, you know, if that's the error band around the data point, why doesn't the theory go through the error band? And that is, these are error bands calculated on replications of experiments, but in these particular kinds of experiments, there are lots of reasons that a particle that strikes the surface might bounce off the surface, because there's already a particle there, or for a variety of reasons it might bounce off. There are no reasons that particles that don't strike the surface would attach to that surface. So the experiment is inherently biased toward smaller capture efficiencies than would otherwise occur. So we would expect the data to never exceed, but probably to be somewhat below that line. And in this case, again, we think that the prediction is actually probably a little more reliable than the data, but the data still serve a valuable role of validating the overall idea. So we're going to multiple particles now. I'll skip several of the other experiments we do. And these are pilot scale facilities now. This is a reactor which is 2.5 meters tall, roughly about a meter in diameter, where we actually create a flow that's similar in its major characteristics to an industrial burner flow. So these flows are quite complex, actually. They typically have two or three channels. The outermost channel is a swirling channel, so the air is swirling around the outside. In the center, where the fuel is typically located, is usually not swirling, but sometimes stagnated for other reasons. And so if you get the critical idea of these burners, these are called swirl-stabilized burners, and the critical idea to understand here is if you have a swirling flow, the swirl creates a very low-pressure region right at the center of the swirling action. But as it comes out of the burner, the swirl the rate of swirling decreases because the area increases dramatically. And so if you're going along the center line, what happens is the pressure goes from a low pressure along the center line, the pressure starts to increase because the rate of swirling of the air around the outside is decreasing, and hence the swirl-induced pressure drop is decreasing. So even though on average, as you go through this burner, the average pressure, in some sense, is dropping as you move in this direction, along the center line, the pressure is actually increasing in that direction. And that has the effect of reversing the flow right at the center line and creating a recirculation zone here. So if you were a fluid particle coming right down this pipe, you would first be at a low pressure region and then an increasing pressure region, and that's going to turn the flow around, and you actually get a little recirculation zone right at the center. So particles that are induced in that flow slow down. But aerodynamically, then you create what's effectively a bluff body in this flow, and it slows the particles down and captures them in a center core. And what these maps show on the right are experimental measurements of, in this case, hydrogen cyanide concentrations from a pure coal, from a blend of coal and biomass, and from a pure biomass. Pure coal biomass and then the blend of biomass on the right, the HCN concentrations being generated from these fuels. And so you'll see from the coal, first of all, the HCN concentration peaks at a higher value than it does from the biomass. But the coal particles are smaller and they form a little more compact flame. Hydrogen cyanide, well, I guess if you never been involved in the combustion literature, here's a few things to understand. So you're generating several hundred ppm potentially of hydrogen cyanide in these fluids. That's a lot of hydrogen cyanide. It only gets generated in a fuel-rich region, so hydrogen cyanide reacts rapidly with oxygen to form NO and other compounds. And so this marks, we also measure CO and all the other compounds, but this would be a fuel-rich region of an average fuel-rich region in an otherwise fuel-lean kind of a flow. So the overall stoichiometry is there's more oxygen than you need, but in this location, because of that swirling flow that I talked about, a number of the particles get locked in here, and the nitrogen compounds evolve from the coal, and they form predominantly HCN in the case of coal, and predominantly ammonia in the case of biomass. So also interestingly, what you see here is that there's two peaks, fairly pronounced peaks in the case of the biomass fuel, with one of them down here. The biomass particles are in general larger, but the main reason for this peak, this is a co-firing of straw. So those of you who have picked up grass or straw in the field and chew on it when you hike through the mountains, straw is some relatively cylindrical parts that are locked together with what we call knees. So these joints between the straw compounds are, they call those knees of the straw. And the knees are quite a bit more dense, roughly the same diameter, but quite a bit more dense than the bulk of the straw. And those dense knees actually propagate down here, and the knees don't burn until they get down here. But the bulk of the straw and all of the coal, well, in this case, it's just straw is burning up here. And then when you blend them together, you get some intermediate behavior. So we do, in this pilot scale facility, we make these measurements where we measure things like ammonia, HCN, all the stable gases, CO, water, we measure hydrogen, pollutants, sulfur, and NOx, and try to understand these flows. And one of the things that we came to understand in these experiments is that at least in these flows, there's actually no location in this burner. So if you could see the flame, there'd be a flame, big flame that you would be able to see by eye here, or a much longer flame here. But inside that flame, there's actually no location where you never have any oxygen present. So the probe at that location, well, what it's sensing is, for a short time, it will sense some very fuel-rich regions where there's no oxygen. But then for a short time, it will sense some oxygen-containing gas. And it's a intermittent series of eddies that come through with no oxygen and a lot of oxygen, no oxygen and a lot of oxygen, or very high CO, relatively low CO, all stacked together. And what you see here is the average of those compositions as they pile up here. So this goes to, I don't have the slides yet because we're just completing the next stage of this, is now we go to a commercial scale burner. So now this building actually fits in the duct of one of these large scale coal combustors. For those who aren't familiar with the way power is generated, it's at a scale that is mind-boggling. It's astounding. So processing literally hundreds of tons of air per hour and tens of tons of coal per hour or biomass per hour through these very large scale facilities, 30-story tall combustor with a 15-story tall flame inside of it. So these are large scale systems, and we're going to make similar measurements to these in these very large scale burners, where they'd have a maybe 30 of these kinds of burners injecting coal and biomass. So what's the interest in coal and biomass to start with? We've been burning coal for a long time, and for the most part, I'll show you some slides in a minute to show that things really have changed a lot, but a lot of the experience in the field, commercial experience with coal, comes from just that experience. And so not necessarily a lot of good science and engineering applied, but you have a boiler and a coal, and over a period of time you learn what you can and can't do with this boiler, and operationally you develop some very good expertise, but not necessarily very science-based expertise on these flames. But things are changing now. The reason that we would put biomass in a boiler is that the biomass, if you can put biomass in a coal-fired boiler, you can convert biomass to electricity with nearly the same efficiency as you do a large-scale boiler. Now, if you were to build just a dedicated biomass-fired power plant, we've done similar field tests to this on 70 of those dedicated biomass power plants. There were 73 of them in the state of California alone, where I used to live. I've been to just about all of them. But the problem is that biomass is not a very energy dense material. It has less than a tenth of the energy density of coal, and it's typically seasonally available. It's not available basically year round like coal is, and so the largest realistically sized biomass boiler that you can build usually produces about 50 megawatts of electricity, and at that scale you can't afford to put the high tolerance turbines, the reheat cycles, and the other kinds of things into this facility that make it a very highly efficient, relatively efficient conversion facility. So if you take this, for example, in California, we did this, so we looked at the average efficiency of 70 dedicated biomass boilers, and the conversion efficiency of fuel to electricity was below 11%. Many of those were really garbage processing facilities. They weren't actually garbage processing, but that's the way they were operated. So if you look at just the well-operated biomass conversion facilities, the ones that are really trying to maximize electrical power output as opposed to maximize the amount of fuel they can put through the facility, that still the conversion efficiencies are about 18%. And most of that has to do with the size of the facility. It's nothing inherently wrong with biomass except that its energy density is so low that if you were to build a gigawatt-sized dedicated biomass-sized facility, you'd be collecting biomass from four states to try to fire it, and that's just not realistic because it almost always comes by truck. So if you go to a coal-fired facility and put the same amount of biomass in a large coal-fired facility, the biomass gets converted to electricity with better than twice the efficiency. So now the typical modern coal-fired facility has about a 38 to 40% conversion efficiency of chemical energy to electrical power at the end of the day. So you can get more than twice the amount of electricity out of a given amount of biomass when you put it in a coal-fired boiler than you can if you build a boiler dedicated just to the biomass by itself. And those kinds of efficiency gains are what makes sense. And there's a theme in most of what I'll talk about is that the combination of fossil and biomass resources together often makes more sense than either resource by itself makes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But moving on with some of our other experiments in our laboratory. So once you've burned the material, one of the potential major implications of biomass is that biomass has a number of things that aren't very healthy for boilers. It really isn't particularly actively growing biomass is really probably not a good choice for fuel because in order to grow, so hopefully everybody realizes that the carbon in the biomass comes from the atmosphere, but there's a lot of inorganic material in biomass. Straw, for example, rice straw, sometimes has 23 to 25% of its mass in the form of silica. And this isn't dirt that gets mixed in with the rice straw. This is material that actually comes through the roots, is dissolved as silicic acid, and gets deposited in a plant as a critical part of the plant. When you snap a piece of straw, it snaps primarily because of the silica, not because of the carbon and the hydrogen. So the silicon actually is not an organic part. It's not a living part of the plant, but it's an inherent part of the structure of the plant. It's what allows straw to stand up in the wind and not fall over like grass does, which allows a crop to eventually grow. But the other thing that comes in and what actually regulates the rate of moisture coming through the plant, and it's moisture that controls the rate of plant growth more than anything else, is usually potassium, usually in the form of potassium chloride. And that potassium is great for plants and horrible for boilers. And so one of the things that the potassium does, it does a lot of things. It's corrosive. It forms horrible deposits, but it also is a poison to the types of catalysts that we use to reduce NOx emissions from power plants. And so a modern power plant, once you go through the power plant and clean things up, actually just before you get to the end, you pass all of that flue gas through a large catalytic system. The catalytic system, again, the scales of everything are huge. The catalyst itself will often be about 20 stories tall, 20 stories of packed bed or some sort of a typically monolithic catalyst that process this flue gas. And what this shows are some experiments that we were doing. These are in situ spectroscopically based measurements of, in this case, the NOx reduction rate versus temperature for a fresh catalyst shown here, and then catalysts that have been poisoned with various biomass-containing components, including calcium, sodium, and potassium. And you can see eventually that if you get half as much potassium as there is vanadium, vanadium is part of the active catalyst here, you actually reduce that activity to zero. So as the potassium deposits in this catalyst, you potentially are going to destroy this whole catalytic bed and destroy the NOx conversion efficiency, the NOx control efficiency of the power plant. It turns out, though, that while this does happen, the bigger problem is just the deposition of just the fouling of the surface, just a mechanical blocking of pores in this catalyst. That's actually a larger concern than this chemical deactivation of the surface of the catalyst. And then finally, when you get to the end of the process, you have a bunch of fly ash left over. Fly ash is a significant liability if you just landfill it, for example. But it turns out you can mix fly ash as a mixture in concrete, so displace some of the cement and concrete with fly ash, and in the long term, that actually fairly significantly improves the properties of the concrete. It has some short-term negative effects, but it increases the strength, the durability, makes the concrete less susceptible to several critical reactions, including the alkali aggregate reaction, which is one of the biggest concerns right now. So adding fly ash to concrete is, for the most part, a good thing. It's a good thing because it gives you, you actually can sell the fly ash to the concrete industry, but the money is less important than getting rid of the liability of landfilling the material if you're a power plant operator, and the concrete properties improve. But largely because of this work, I actually sit on the ASTM committee that's responsible for the standards that describe what kind of fly ash can be put in concrete. And one of the phrases in that standard says that everything in the fly ash has to come from coal. And if you blend biomass with coal, you no longer have some of the fly ash comes from biomass and some of it comes from coal, and it's blended together in a way that you could never separate it. So these are a series of experiments trying to see if blends of biomass and coal fly ash have any negative impacts relative to normal just coal-based fly ash in these kinds of applications. And in the process of doing this, this isn't the first time this has been done, but there are only three of these kinds of reactors. So we're trying to track the chemistry of what's going on in this piece of concrete. And all concrete has a lot of water in it, a lot of excess water. You'd like to be able to get that water out. But the concrete that you walk on may not look like it when you walk on your sidewalk out there, but there's actually a lot of water in that concrete that isn't really required to be part of this cementitious reactor. And so we came up with a way of trying to extract that water just basically by squeezing the concrete. But it takes an enormous amount of pressure to do that. So we first designed this vessel to say for the pressures that we would have to generate to squeeze this water out of the concrete, you needed a forklift to lift the vessel that would hold that. And so we redesigned it using some fairly innovative techniques that we didn't originate. They came out of the literature, but it ended up being a relatively small vessel that we then put in the biggest, meanest looking machine that the civil engineering department had, and squeeze the water out of the concrete and look at the chemistry of the water. And from that we can calculate, we can watch the reaction rates as a function of time. These are kinetics the way that they ought to be done. So these are reactions where the time constants are measured in months and years rather than in microseconds, like typical kinetic reactions. And we're able to demonstrate that there really are no problems with practical biomass. So those are some of the experiments. Let me go through now some of the other material that we wanted to talk about. And first, just orient you to the energy flow in the United States, and I'll show you in a minute, this is the whole world. So this is the whole energy diagram. The left shows you where energy comes from, coal, natural gas, crude oil, all the sources of energy. And the right shows you where it goes to. But in the middle here, I've drawn this red line, and that red line represents the fraction of the energy that goes through a combustion process. So of all of the energy that we consume in the United States, roughly 85% of it goes through some sort of a combustion process. So combustion and energy are essentially equivalent. The only significant contributors to energy right now that don't go through a combustion process on a national basis are nuclear and hydropower. And there are a few others, solar and wind, but on this scale, solar and wind are about the thickness of that line, so in terms of the contribution to the national energy supply. So 85% of the energy in the United States comes through a combustion process, and this scales between 80 and 100% here, but these are different fractions of the world. If you divide the world up into the what we might call the developed or the non-developed regions of the world, the OPEC nations, the International Energy Agency members, the EU, or look at the world total, and you can see that 85% is a pretty good estimate worldwide, and unless you get to very small regions. If you look at Iceland, for example, that's not a very good estimate for how much combustion energy there is, or for France, but or Lithuania. But if you take any reasonably large section of the world, about 85% of the total energy supply comes through a combustion process. So you would think the energy industry is huge. It represents about 12% of our GDP directly, but about 26% of our GDP indirectly. That is, the GDP reacts to energy prices as if it were about 25% of the GDP. And so that energy is a strategically important quantity. And if you look, go back to 1970, which is a great year to start, because this is where we first started getting serious in the United States, actually most of the world, about environmental impacts of energy. Up until then, we pretty much just polluted things. But we passed the first version of the Clean Air Act here, and we started making some serious environmental progress in this region. Since that time, the gross domestic product has increased by about 170%, if you take this out to current years, more than 150% increase in the number of miles we drive cars. So we used to walk or ride a bicycle a lot more than we do now, just 30 years ago. There's been roughly a 40 to 50% increase in both the energy consumption and energy population. But significantly, there's been a 25% decrease in the total amount, not the amount per unit energy, but in the total amount of pollution emitted from energy in that same amount of time. So in the same time that we've increased energy production by 50%, we've decreased in absolute terms the environmental impact of that energy by 25, almost 30% if you take this out to 2008 now. For an industry of this size, that's an incredible undertaking. In fact, if you had asked me at this point whether that was possible, well, at this point, I wouldn't have known too much about anything, but to look forward for an energy this size, an industry this size, and say that you could make that kind of environmental progress in those years, that's an astounding accomplishment. And it's a combination of a lot of work on the part of regulators, politicians, engineers, and operators, that is, companies. But all of these pollutants, this is some sort of an average between NOx, SOx, particles, all the things that that energy does. All of that pollution that we're talking about is an unnecessary part of the fuel. That is, if there were no sulfur in diesel or coal, we would be delighted. The sulfur doesn't enhance the combustion process at all. The same is true of the nitrogen, the chlorine, the particles. So if you had a fuel without any of that material in it, like natural gas, that would be a fantastic fuel. So mostly we've been dealing with impurities. Now, if you look to the future, we're talking about CO2. That's the heart and soul of the coal. It's the conversion of the carbon and the hydrogen to CO2 and water that is the source of the energy, and it's 85% of the energy. So we're no longer dealing with contaminants or impurities in the fuel. We're dealing with the heart and soul of the fuel now. And the challenge of doing something about CO2 is going to be much, much larger than the challenges of having dealt with SOx and NOx in the past. So as impressive as the accomplishments of the past are, the future is going to be much, much more challenging, and I'll talk a little bit now about what that future is. So this is the total CO2 emissions from the United States, roughly divides into roughly a third of the CO2 comes from transportation, roughly a third from power generation, and a third from everything else. Now, I have talked a little bit about biomass, and I'm a strong advocate of biomass, but this little wedge that you see here is the maximum amount the biomass could ever contribute, I think, to this energy picture. This is just coal shown here. This isn't. This is just, if you look at this as a fraction of coal, it would be 15% of coal, or roughly 5% of the total energy supply, additional percent, that is as much as you could realistically ever recover from biomass in our current energy preserves. So biomass by itself is not going to be a solution to this problem. We can do many great things with biomass, and that's true with renewable energies in general. There simply is not enough renewable energy at any realistic kind of cost to address the energy concerns. Now, there's more than enough solar energy falling on the earth, for example, to supply energy. But if you look at the costs of converting that to usable energy and what that would potentially do to the economy, that's not a very realistic scenario. So what do I mean by sustainability? People talk about sustainability in different ways, and many people, in fact, all of the federal programs that are currently on the books, if they say sustainable, what they really mean is security, and what they usually say is security. So the reason that we convert, the reason that we talk about a hydrogen economy, for example, has nothing to do with sustainability. If we run our nation on hydrogen, it will without question consume more energy and almost surely generate more environmental impact than what we're currently doing right now. But it is a way that we could potentially could shift away from imported petroleum and toward an indigenous supply of energy. So there is a security argument to be made for hydrogen, but there's not a sustainability argument to be made for hydrogen. Same is true of corn-based ethanol. But security is part of the sustainability picture. There's also what I'll call durable, which might, you could say renewable, but in a minute I'll talk about why I say durable instead of renewable. And that is, we need enough energy that we can see into the future far enough with this energy supply that we'll be able to continue to use this source of energy. For example, coal, we have, by most estimates, of 450 years of coal supply in the United States. We have much less than that of petroleum. So arguably, if coal would be a durable fuel, petroleum perhaps not. We don't have more than 100 years. Most people would say more than 50 years of petroleum reserves left. And finally, affordable. If you look carefully at the economics of the situation, you can actually do considerably more damage to the quality of life, not talking about being able to drive big cars and things like that, but to the actual health and well-being of humans or anybody else on or any other animal life on this planet by destroying the economy than you can by other environmental impacts. So if you go to an energy infrastructure that is unaffordable and economies collapse, people lose jobs and industries collapse, you're actually doing damage even in an environmental sense. And so there's some intersection between these that I call sustainable. So sustainable means we want to find something which is secure, which is durable, and which is affordable, and that we can move forward with in order to address this issue. And so, well, let me say, and what do we mean? Gro Brundtland, who is somewhat of a hero of mine, first woman prime minister of Norway, and she did the first of these, what have become these United Nations reports in 1987, probably the most formative document on the whole discussion of sustainability. And in that document, she defined sustainable as providing for current energy needs without compromising future resources. I actually shouldn't have put energy in there. The energy is in the, she was talking about sustainability in all context, not just energy, but so that's kind of the mantra that we take, is trying to do both of those things. So if you look at what I consider to be realistic projections of where energy is going to come from in the future, here you can see this is for world energy supplies. This shows that coal is actually going to be increasing. This is coal followed by natural gas, followed by petroleum. This is the Chinese impact on petroleum, but then it's actually showing that it's going to be decreasing. And then here is nuclear power. And if you look at current energy generation, here are the renewables down here, and it shows that biomass in particular will increase fairly significantly, with small increases in some of the other energy generation. And there are lots of diagrams like this, and you can argue about what they are, but none of the realistic ones show these renewable components compensating for all of that energy generation that we currently have. And it's probably unrealistic to think that that can happen. Not that we shouldn't pursue renewable energies. We should do everything we can for those renewable energies, but we should also recognize that they are at best a part of the solution, not the whole solution. And so we'll talk a little bit about other parts of the solution. So if you look at CO2 emissions globally, address the CO2 problem. So globally, we generate a huge amount of CO2 emissions. You can see where those come from different nations. The coal-derived portions of that are shown here. So if we're going to do something about CO2, probably coal-fired power plants are the best place to start, partly because they represent the single largest contributor to CO2 emissions, but mostly because they're stationary and you can afford to put large-scale equipment that's going to do something about it. Capturing CO2 from an automobile or from an airplane, for example, is going to be much, much more difficult than capturing CO2 from a coal-fired power plant. So this is the low-hanging fruit, if you will, the right place to start for CO2 kinds of emissions. So if you estimate what it's going to cost to clean up the CO2, and I'll show you these estimates in just a minute, if you do the 30% of the total cleanup, which is the minimum that you can do and actually expect to have any impact on the climate change, that's going to be a little bit over $500 billion a year enterprise globally, about $125 billion a year in the U.S. Or if we do 100% of coal, that turns out to be a little over 30% globally, then we're looking at something like almost $650 billion a year industry, which today is zero. That industry right now, nobody is doing this. So in the United States, it'd be $125 billion a year industry just to clean up the CO2. So how are we going to do that? What ways can we accomplish that? So this graph, I'll go through fairly quickly, but if you were to build a coal-fired power plant right now with no CO2 sequestration technology, this shows the levelized cost of electricity in cents per kilowatt hour. And so it turns out to be about 6 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, I didn't check. I should have in Indiana. I'm guessing that your generation costs in Indiana are lower than 6 cents per kilowatt hour, but that's because there are very, very few brand new boilers in the United States. The average lifetime, the average age of a coal-fired boiler in the United States is almost 50 years. And so the great majority of these, if you look at where that cost comes from, more than half of the cost of electrical power generation is associated in the capitalization of the power plant. So when you pay your electrical power bill, half of that bill is going to just pay for the capital that goes into the plant, and only about a third of it goes for paying for the fuel. And so places that have old power plants that have long since been paid off, their generation rates are actually much lower than the 6 cents. But if you were to build a new power plant, this is with modern technology, this is about where the costs of power generation would be. In 10 years, it'll be here. We'll actually consume less fuel, but cost more energy. We're higher materials with higher temperatures, more efficient power plants will slightly increase the cost. And the reason that there are no gasifiers yet, although Indiana is changing that, but there are almost no gasifiers in commercial production right now, is because gasification has always been more expensive than combustion for power generation. There are great technical advantages to doing this gasification, but the business case has never been there. So the rest of these charts show what the cost of power is going to be if you do CO2 sequestration. So if you take this same power plant, and depending on the technology you use for CO2 capture, you're increasing the cost of power by about 80%. And so the electrical power generation costs will increase about 80%, and it's about the same regardless of whether you use some solvent-based scrubbing solution or these are air separation units, so-called oxy-firing, where you fire just oxygen in the combustor and you generate a pure CO2 stream at the back end. These are transport membranes for generating oxygen. This is IGCC with CO2 sequestration, and you can see that all of those are essentially the same cost, and they average to about 80% increase in electrical power generation cost, and not shown on this diagram, about a 30% decrease in the efficiency of power generation, which is a huge, huge hit. This last one, this BX1, that's Baxter 1, that's the process that we've been innovating, which if you look at it on this diagram, these are the actual costs of avoiding producing a ton of CO2. They average to about $57 a ton, and we have a process that we think is closer to $33 a ton for this CO2. So what's this process look like? We dry out the flue gas, compress it slightly, go through a heat exchange here that I'll talk about in a minute. In this process, we can actually remove the SOx, the mercury, some of the acid gases, go through an expansion to the point that we're at a cryogenic temperature now. This is depending upon how much CO2 you want to remove, somewhere between a negative 120 and a negative 135 degrees, where CO2 solidifies. You separate the solids and pressurize those, form them into a liquid, and produce a pressurized liquid CO2 stream, which is now ready to be pumped into an aquifer somewhere for sequestration. And you produce a nitrogen-rich stream with a little bit of oxygen and other things in it in this process. The heat exchange here is the main way that you cool this down, with some expansion to go through that separation process. So separating gases by this cryogenic process perhaps sounds expensive. It is expensive, but compared to other alternatives for CO2, it's pretty cheap. So let me zoom forward here to show why it's cheap. So the closest comparable technology are the so-called air separation units, where on the front end you separate nitrogen and oxygen, and then you fire the combustor with just the oxygen, and in the end you produce just a CO2 stream, so you don't have to do a separation in the tail end, you just have to compress it. So where are the energy demands and costs associated with that? So for the air separation unit, you have this heat exchange process, but that's more or less a wash. Since you're cooling it down to, in the case of air, you're separating nitrogen and oxygen, you have to cool it down to a little bit below a negative 200 degrees Celsius. But the same material is heating back up, so mainly the costs and the energy loss here, the energy losses anyway, are associated with just the losses in the process. And with an ideal heat exchanger with an infinite surface area, you could cool everything down with the same gases that you're warming back up again to deliver to the combustor. So these costs, from an energy standpoint, are low, but the capital costs are not. The largest investment in energy in the air separation unit is that once you cool the air down, you have a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen. You have liquid and nitrogen and liquid oxygen mixed together, and you have to distill those to purify the nitrogen from the oxygen. And that means you have to boil and recondense them several times in these distillation columns to produce a nitrogen and oxygen stream. And that's where most of the energy goes in these processes. And then finally, once you've fired the system, you have to compress the CO2 on the back end and prepare it for a delivery in the other system. So these are large. This is the air separation unit technology, which costs about the same, both in energy terms and in dollar terms, as the other technologies we've talked about. What we call the cryogenic CO2 capture, C cubed, if you will, or triple C, is this BX1 process. On this end, we put this on the back end. We have heat exchange. Since we're going to a lower temperature, a higher temperature, less cooling involved, we have fewer losses. So this would be a smaller energy demand than that, but still small in any case. There is no distillation required because, as I'll show you in a minute, CO2 actually desublimes. It doesn't condense to form a liquid phase. It forms a solid, and in that solid form, it's pure CO2. So there's no need to separate the CO2 from the nitrogen in a distillation column or something like that. And because you have it in a solid form, you can compress it as a solid, or compress it partway as a solid and finish it compressing it as a liquid. And those compression costs are trivially small compared to the cost of compressing a gas that you see here. So the energy costs are fairly obviously much, much lower in here, as are the capital costs. And so if you look through the science of the process, looking at the time, I might skip through this. A couple of take-home messages here, though, is this is a phase diagram for CO2 and nitrogen. It shows the mole fraction of nitrogen. So if you were at this temperature, for example, let's say negative 55 degrees C, and at this pressure, say 100 atmospheres, at negative 55 degrees C and 100 atmospheres, if you start off with a 50-50 mixture of CO2 and nitrogen, you have a liquid phase that looks like this and a gas phase that has this composition, some liquid and some nitrogen in it. But at the composition of a flue gas, which has about 15% CO2, there is no temperature and pressure at which you can generate liquid CO2 from that flue gas. You completely miss this two-phase envelope, so the only thing you can do, which turns out to be a good thing, is to freeze it. So you get it cold enough that it actually freezes rather than condenses as a liquid. And that avoids having to do the separation in the distillation column. And so the temperature and pressure at which you need to come, depending upon how much CO2 you need to remove, at this point you start to frost CO2. And you get the 90, 95, and 99% removal of CO2 at these combinations of temperature and pressure in this system. So these are cold temperatures, to be sure. But by comparison to the air separation unit, which operates at a negative 200 and some degrees, this is relatively easily accomplished in terms of energy and capital expense. So it's much cheaper than the air separation unit and the other units. And then finally, once you form the solid, you just pressurize the solid and heat it up, and you can form a liquid, which is easier to handle. And so there are a bunch of plant integration advantages as well. But that's just one example of one of the perhaps innovative ways that we can improve the CO2 capture, the costs, the energy costs, and the economic costs of sequestering CO2. So let me get to the last part of this, if bear with me for a minute. This is a picture of a Hopi Indian. The Hopi Indians live not far from my home, just on the Nevada-Arizona border. They're one of the more ancient Indian tribes. They've been in that area for about as long as people can track back. And they're farmers. And I don't know how many of you have ever been to northern Arizona or southern Utah, but that's a pretty difficult region to try to farm. It's extremely dry. So these are very practical people. They live off the land. They're a farming community. And a community that I have some association with. But one of the phrases that comes out of this community, which I really like, is how does this talk grow corn? So if you can imagine a group of Hopi Indian elders sitting around talking about some issue, they're short on talk and long on action. They don't have the luxury of talking about things. They actually have to really solve problems. And that's the mode we need to get into with these sustainability issues. There are real answers on the table right now, things that we can really do. And if you will permit one more analogy, if you go back even further to the development of humans as a species, the humans developed in the Rift Valley in Africa, and relatively slowly migrated as a species north and south, because as you go north and south, you come to different climates and have to learn to deal with different kinds of animals and different kinds of plants, and that's a slow process. And so humans stayed here for a long time, slowly going north and south, but eventually they got up to the subcontinental area, and then very rapidly progressed across southern Asia, and eventually they got, people estimate, some 50, possibly 60,000 years ago, the first humans arrived in Australia, the ancestors of the current Aborigines. There's no way to get to Australia. In those days, the ocean wasn't as deep as it is now. But even then, for example, New Guinea and Australia were one landmass in those days. But still, in those days, it's not possible to get to Australia without being able to sail past the horizon and be able to navigate in some sense. Nobody knows what sense, and find your way back. And it's also not possible that a single raft or even relatively big ship full of people could have crashed there and generated the gene pool that eventually became the Aborigines. It takes many hundred people to populate the kind of people that live in Australia right now in terms of the diversity of genes that they see in Australia. So there's every reason to believe that the first Australians were probably the most technologically advanced human beings on the Earth at the time they got to Australia. They probably were able to navigate. They must have known something about stars or some other navigation technique. And so the huge question comes is, why is it then that just relatively, you know, this is 60,000 years ago, so on that scale yesterday, why is it that Captain Cook sailed from Europe all the way around here and so we say discovered Australia, instead of the Australians perhaps tens of thousands of years earlier having sailed to Europe and even populating Europe from Australia? And at least the anthropologists say the reason is that when the Australians got to Australia, the animals in Australia had never seen human beings before. And we're not very intimidating looking in the animal kingdom. We're slow, and we're not very big by comparison to really big animals. But what the animals in Australia didn't know, and the ones in Africa did, is that we are excellent hunters. And they hunted to extinction all of the large animals in Australia in the first perhaps couple of centuries that they were there, with the unintended consequence that they eliminated any source of work that was more than what a human being could do. And so, and if you look back at our history, the development, the early technological development in Europe came through beasts of burden like oxes and horses and other kinds of things. They had hunted to extinction all of those, the equivalent kinds of animals in Australia, and all they had were left were relatively small animals that couldn't do that kind of work. Now, it would have taken an incredibly clairvoyant Aborigine to look forward 50,000 years and say we shouldn't hunt these animals because 50,000 years from now we're going to need them to develop our society. That would have been a hard argument even if you would have tried to make it. But in an analogy, in my view, we're doing the same thing now. That is, and with far less excuse. I don't think there is any question that for as long as civilization will exist, energy will be an essential component of civilization. And we know that we are consuming energy at rates that far exceed the capacity of the planet to regenerate that energy. There's no question about that. And so we are very much aware of what the Aborigines didn't know, and that was we are destroying the resources that will be critical to the continued development of our society. And that's where my passion comes from. These are important issues that really need to be addressed. So if I look at the bottom line issues here, if we look at sustainability in the long run, it's going to take all of these things in order for us to become a more sustainable environment. It's going to take all of the practical renewable energy options, where I can include conservation as one of those renewable energy options. But that, at best, is only going to be a part of the solution. It's going to require a much smarter, better use of fossil energy, which is also going to be a part of the solution. It's going to include a substantial increase in the nuclear power production, I think, which will be a part of the solution. But even with all of those things in the long term, if we're talking about a 150 to 200 year time frame, it's going to require a significant change in lifestyle for perhaps the entire developed world. Accomplishing these things will require a global cooperation that's unprecedented on this globe. The last time that countries really, really bled for one another, really compromised their own well-being for the sake of other countries, was probably during World War II in any significant way. It's going to take more and more unified and more significant cooperation, in my opinion, than we saw even during World War II to solve these problems. And where are we going to find the leaders that are going to do that? I'm hoping that somewhere there are students that will catch this vision and will develop into those leaders who have both the technical and the social capability to inspire countries, not just one country, but countries along the globe to embrace this challenge. So the conclusions I've largely talked about. So the big changes in energy and industry, but we really need an unprecedented kind of, there has never been a greater need for well-trained engineers and scientists working in well-equipped laboratories, I think, than there is now in the energy industry. Let me finish by acknowledging a host of graduate students and faculty colleagues and others who have made all of this work possible, most of whom have done the great majority of the work. And I just get to talk about it, and with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Larry. Questions now?
I have two questions. One is a very general one, but the other is a very, very specific one, in fact, and they're both very opposite in nature in some sense, in considering their scope. So my very general question is, you showed a slide on the 85% of energy being in combustion processes. So in that part, you were including automobiles and things right. of this sort. So where does it break down? How much is the automobile and the general transportation industry versus the power generation? So that would be my general question. I'll have a very
all right. Let me answer that one first. So the question is, what fraction of power generation energy comes from combustion processes? So in the United States, about 53% of electrical power generation is based on coal combustion, another 20% on natural gas combustion, and the remaining roughly 35 to 40% comes from a combination of nuclear and hydropower for the most part.
So overall combustion, then when you said 85% of all energy is utilized in combustion processes, that includes automobiles.
Right.
So
if you look at transportation, for example, very nearly 100% of transportation energy comes from combustion, right? There are almost nothing else there. So
if we take all of combustion and we say how much is transportation and how much is energy generation for power, how would that split?
In energy units, transportation is the largest energy consumer, but in CO2 units they're roughly equal, because petroleum doesn't generate as much CO2 per unit energy as coal, for example, in power generation. So if you look at the CO2 issue specifically, roughly one-third of the CO2 generation comes from power generation, one-third from transportation, and one-third from all other energy uses, which would be residential heating and industrial or commercial use of energy for the most part.
My detailed technical question actually goes back to the very first part of your talk, and that dealt with that single particle levitation experiment. I have some interest in that myself as well. And So I am aware of previous works, for example, of Barziev and Sarafin, and of, so you can see that I have some right. interest in that, goes back to that direction, yeah. And Maloney and people like Jim Davis, who made the initial electrobalances for other applications, but then Sarafin and Barziev, many, many years, did single particle levitation experiments. So specifically, in your own research, what are the contributions that you have made that differentiate what you have versus what was known in the literature?
Yeah. So these particles have no electromagnetic component to their levitation. They're being levitated entirely, in this case, by a laser beam. There's no electrical charge involved, and so they can be levitated at arbitrary temperatures and arbitrary pressures. Unlike the electrodynamic balance, if the particle gets too hot, then it loses its charge and falls out of the balance. And so they're really completely different. They're aimed at the same end, but they're some completely different approaches to levitating a particle and being able to study its lifetime over.
So you can go to the entire extinction point when they all burn off completely.
Well, I didn't say that, and I won't say that because we actually haven't done that yet. But that's my expectation, is that we have burned particles, but we're still working out the details of controlling the levitation process carefully and making the kinds of measurements you see here. We haven't actually measured kinetic rates at pressurized conditions yet. That's the next step. So.